It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM, WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbrand.
Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn me around.
This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
The real problem is that the program isn't capped. So, for example, the big box retailers get millions of dollars from this program because they have tremendous volumes in sales. Walmart alone, for example, gets over $4 million a year in Virginia from the dealer discount program.
Michael Cassidy, Executive Director of the Commonwealth Institute, explains how Virginia's $3 billion budget hole could be closed without harmful spending cuts by carefully closing wasteful tax loopholes. And in our weekly question and answer session, you'll find out how to extend your health insurance if you lose your job and why it's so hard to do that. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 36, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. The dispute system set up by the Fair Credit Reporting Act to allow consumers to protect their credit reports has been automated into a travesty of justice, according to the National Consumer Law Center. Their report documents how the three major credit bureaus, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion, handle credit reporting disputes in a perfunctory and formalistic manner. Credit bureaus translate detailed disputes, painstakingly written by desperate consumers, into two- or three-digit codes. Fail to send documents submitted by consumers, such as canceled checks or payoff statements, to creditors, and limit their employees who handle disputes to little more than selecting these two- or three-digit codes. Workers don't examine documents, contact consumers by phone or email, or exercise any discretion in resolving a dispute. Because disputes are a cost item, the bureaus have minimized their expenses to the point that one bureau pays its dispute handling vendor in the Philippines a mere 57 cents per dispute letter. The full report is available at www.nclc.org. In other news, over the past 13 years, more than 100,000 elderly and disabled Americans have lost their Social Security and SSI benefits because of an arbitrary and unlawful policy. The Social Security Administration claims to be applying a 1996 law which prohibits payment of benefits to people who are fleeing to avoid prosecution for a felony. Yet, SSA makes no attempt to determine if the person is actually fleeing or even knows the criminal charges are pending. Numerous individuals have challenged the policy in court, and SSA has lost every reported decision. Each time, the courts have ruled that the policy is unlawful and ordered reinstatement of benefits because there must be a finding of a particular intent to avoid prosecution, including a court order or warrant finding that the person was fleeing to avoid prosecution, before benefits can be suspended. Yet, SSA continues to apply this policy without regard to the court rulings. Recently, the policy was challenged by a nationwide class action, which remains pending. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond's independent radio.
This week's legal term of the week is Medicare. Medicare is a national health insurance program run by the Social Security Administration. Part A covers some of the cost of hospitalization, extended care facilities such as nursing homes, and home health services. Part B covers some of the cost of medical expenses such as doctor's fees, outpatient treatment, and laboratory work. Part D covers some of the cost of prescription drugs. Medicare is like an insurance program and should not be confused with Medicaid, which is like a welfare program. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and that's this week's Legal Term of the Week.
It's time for the weekly question and answer session. We're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Tell us your name and where you're from.
My name's Susan, and I'm from Richmond.
Thank you, Susan, and thank you for being on the show. What question do you have for us this week?
I have a question regarding private health insurance, and I'd like to know if there are legal protections for persons who have pre-existing medical conditions in order to get coverage for that.
Susan, don't we wish? Unfortunately, there are not, at least if you don't have continuation of your coverage under COBRA. This has been quite in the news recently. If you do have private health insurance, you know, usually through your employer, and a qualifying circumstance results, you know, typically you lose your job through some reason, whether it's a layoff or even if you quit or even if you are discharged, the employer is required to offer continuation of the coverage under COBRA, which stands for Consolidated Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act from some act many, many years ago. But what it requires you to do is to pay the premiums that otherwise your employer was paying. Well, those premiums can be several hundred dollars a month for an individual. They can be over $1,000 a month for a family. And hey, you've just lost your job. So how are you going to be able to afford COBRA coverage even if you get unemployment compensation? It's very difficult for most folks. So what a lot of folks do in that situation, if they can't have the COBRA coverage, they try to go out and get other insurance. But that's where the pre-existing condition problems come in, because to get other insurance from some other company, they're going to ask you all sorts of things about your prior health condition, and they can turn you down for some sort of pre-existing condition. So this is something that hopefully the new policies in the new administration may deal with. It's certainly beyond the scope of this program to deal with that, except to say that if people are wrongfully denied their COBRA coverage, that's certainly something that they ought to bring to legal aid. But again, they need to realize that they're going to have to come up with the premiums. Were you in a situation where you had COBRA coverage and it was not continued for some reason?
I am currently in that situation.
Right. And basically, you can keep the coverage if you can pay for it, but you're having a problem paying for it.
Exactly.
That sort of is the crux of the whole problem. Well, thank you for being on the show. Appreciate your question. We're here at the Virginia Interfaith Center for Public Policy, and we're talking with Michael Cassidy. He is the director of the Commonwealth Institute, and we will be talking about fiscal, budget, and revenue policy. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you very much.
Now, we are in the middle of the Virginia General Assembly session. Tell us, what are the issues that are impacting the General Assembly's fiscal and budget policies?
Well, the budget is one of the central debates going on right now in Virginia during the General Assembly, mostly because the General Assembly is struggling to close an estimated $3.2 billion shortfall in the state's budget due to the worsening economy that the state is experiencing, and that's part of the deep and national economic crisis. Virginia's budget has been thrown into the red, and so the General Assembly is working to close that gap. Included in the governor's budget are a few key revenue proposals that have been hotly debated so far in the General Assembly. For example, he's looking to close three loopholes on the tax expenditure side of the budget. This is kind of the hidden side of the budget that is stuff that's baked into the tax code, different tax credits and exemptions and deductions that are sort of on autopilot in any given normal budget year. But given that money is so tight, the governor has proposed to look at three of these. One is restructuring our state's land preservation tax credit. The other is eliminating a program called the dealer discount program, where retailers get to skim a piece of the sales tax everybody pays and hold back for themselves for the cost of doing business and remitting state taxes to Virginia. And then the other one is restructuring the tax provisions related to the real estate investment trusts, which are sort of complicated shell games that a lot of large corporations play with their real estate holdings.
Now, let's go back through those one at a time. What is this land preservation tax credit?
This is a tax credit that's available to individuals who say they own a farm, a family farm, and they decide that they're going to place a lien on that property. And in exchange for agreeing to never have that property be developed, they get a tax credit. The program is a very valuable program in terms of encouraging land preservation throughout the state. But the problem is that the credit has been created to be tradable in recent years, and the cost of the program has exploded. So it went from a fairly small and modest program in prior years to now, in recent years, costing $200 million a year. The governor proposes to restructure this credit and limit the amount that a taxpayer can claim in any given year from the current $100,000 on their tax returns to just $50,000. But in exchange, he is proposing to extend the number of years that they can claim that credit. So even though they'll be able to claim less in any given year, they have more years in which to claim the credit and work off the value of the land they've put in to trust. So we think it's an important and needed reform that won't impact the program negatively. By definition, these are people who are interested in protecting their land in perpetuity. So having a couple extra years to have to claim the credit shouldn't dampen people's interest and enthusiasm in the program, but it's a needed reform. The other one that I mentioned was a program called the Dealer Discount Program. And this is really a throwback to before computers, when retailers who collect the sales tax on behalf of the state. So for example, when you and I go into a store and we buy something, we pay the 5% sales tax. Retailers collect that on behalf of the state at that point of purchase. When they transmit the taxes to the state, they're allowed to keep a piece of that. If they're small retailers, about 3% of their sales tax collections they can hold back. And the idea was to make them whole for their troubles in terms of tracking all the sales tax and remitting those taxes to the state. But now in an age of computers and electronic cash registers and web-based applications, that program seems to have past its prime. And unfortunately, the problem is that the cost of the program is quite significant. It costs the state over $64 million a year to provide these dealer discounts. The real problem is that the program isn't capped. So for example, the big box retailers get millions of dollars from this program because they have tremendous volumes in sales. Walmart alone, for example, gets over $4 million a year in Virginia from the dealer discount program. The governor proposes to eliminate this sales tax dealer discount program and basically acknowledge the fact that in the 21st century internet-based electronic economy, we don't really have to provide retailers with this kind of reimbursement since their marginal cost of doing the transactions is quite minimal.
Well, I can see certainly Walmart could well afford not to get this $4 million subsidy. What about the mom-and-pop retailers? What about them? Would this hurt them in any significant way?
They certainly are not pleased with the governor's proposal. But when you look at the data, the vast majority of retailers in the state, 85% of them, get only an average of $85 a year from this program, which works out to be about $7 a month. And so, in general, a lot of them aren't actually getting that much from the program to begin with. A very small percentage, the top 5%, the big boy retailers, they're the ones who get 70% of the cost of this program. So one possible compromise the General Assembly is potentially considering is to reform the program, not eliminate it, but put a cap on that says, okay, you can still get your discounts, but only to, say, $100 a month. That would protect the small retailers. They'd still get the same amount that they're getting, but we wouldn't have this massive giveaway to big box retailers like Walmart.
And that seems to be where most of that money is going right now.
Exactly. Now, the final other tax provision, which has been getting a lot of press, is, of course, his proposal to double the tobacco tax. The proposal would bring in $154 million in new revenue into the state. And what he's proposing to do is to spend that money through the state's Medicaid program, which is the health insurance program for low-income individuals. The upside of doing it that way is that for every dollar that we would be spending in that program, we would be matched dollar for dollar by the federal government. So that $154 of new spending from the tobacco tax money would actually turn into over $300 million in new healthcare safety net spending here in Virginia.
Now, I've heard the argument made that, well, why does it make sense to link the state's revenues to what is probably, in some manner, a declining source of revenue? After all, cigarette sales are on the decline, which is probably good for public health, but why would we want to link our revenue to something that is in a decline?
Oh, absolutely. Make no mistake about it. This is a Band-Aid in terms of the healthcare needs of the Commonwealth and how to fund them. It certainly should be viewed best as a temporary tax because of what you've mentioned, a declining revenue source due to declining demand overall. In fact, a reduction in demand is the very positive outcome we hope from this increase in the taxes. Studies have shown that by increasing the cost of cigarettes, there is a decline in utilization. And so I think it is best looked at as an appropriate and temporary solution towards providing some needed healthcare revenues for costs, but that people shouldn't fool themselves that somehow this is going to take care of our healthcare needs in the long term here in Virginia.
Which is an excellent segue to, I know, another issue that the Commonwealth Institute deals with, which is healthcare and access to healthcare. What are the issues you're working on in that arena?
So this is a huge issue of concern for so many working Virginians across the state. Virginia, like a lot of our country, is really facing a healthcare crisis in terms of growing ranks of uninsured, growing costs of coverage and insurance. For the second year in a row, the number of uninsured in Virginia have topped 1 million. We have a continued decline in the number of workers who are able to get health insurance through their employer. In this country, you know, that's the primary way people get health insurance is through their job. But as we've documented in several of our reports, the percentage of people in the workforce who are getting their health insurance through their employers has declined in the last several years here in Virginia. And that is a disconcerting slide. In addition, the costs of health insurance are going up. So, for example, in Virginia, we now have the highest cost that employees bear in terms of their health insurance, even if they get it from their employer. So for individual plans, employees pay a larger share of that insurance here in Virginia than in anywhere else in the country. And so all of these pressures are all related to the bigger issue of healthcare, basically a crumbling foundation of the healthcare system. Traditionally, we got it through our work. That's been crumbling. We have very few options to get healthcare outside of our employment. And so these issues come together in a very difficult way for a lot of Virginia workers and Virginia families.
So what are you proposing? I mean, I know for children, there are programs. There's Medicaid for the low income. There's FAMIS, the Family Assistance for Medical Insurance Security for those who are above the low income. What are you proposing in addition to those type of programs?
So there's a lot that Virginia can do even with those two programs. So you mentioned FAMIS, for example, which is our state's children's health insurance program. Virginia could go the way of many other states, which is to expand eligibility for that program. It's currently set at about 200% of the federal poverty limit. We could bring that up. Many states bring that up to three times the federal poverty limit. And beyond that, we could also perhaps allow a buy-in option for people even beyond that. And it could be set at a sliding scale so that the more you make, the more you pay. But it would allow a lot more people to be able to get access for health insurance for their children at affordable rates. That's the key. The way health insurance works is you've got to be in a pool, a big pool, hopefully, of purchasers in order to get the rates down and to make them affordable. Going out on the private market as an individual is very costly. And so if we can leverage off of the large pool of people who are in our state's children's health insurance program, allow access to parents who aren't making that much money but making more than what our current strict requirements are, we could go a long way towards increasing the coverage for uninsured children.
What about the uninsured adults? What would we do for them?
There's a lot there that needs to be done. Virginia has one of the strictest Medicaid eligibility criteria of any other state. We spend very little on our Medicaid program in general here in Virginia. In fact, we are 47th in the country in our per capita expenditures when it comes to Medicaid. If you are, for example, a working adult, so you have no children, but you're working, you can't make any more than $6,000 a year or you're ineligible for Medicaid in Virginia. So it's very, very strict. There's a lot of people out there who are working, can't get health insurance, but they're earning a lot more than $6,000, but by no stretch are they rich, or are they earning so much that you would think they should be able to go into their own budgets and get this kind of coverage.
So you'd be advocating some sort of a buy-in into the Medicaid program for those type of working adults?
Yes. So there'd be sort of several options that would be available for Virginia. One is to simply expand eligibility so that instead of having these incredibly strict income limits, we would raise those so that people who would be earning, say, just if we could go at least to 100% of the poverty limit, then we would be able to cover a lot more working people. In addition, beyond that, we should allow some kind of buy-in option, again, at some kind of sliding scale to allow people access to the program. But in addition, a lot of the problems come from the access that people are lacking from the workplace. As I mentioned, there's been declining coverage through employers for health insurance. Especially a lot of small companies and small businesses find it too expensive to offer coverage for their employees, even though they want to, and it would be a very desirable thing for them to in order to attract talented workers. One of the things the state could do is to offer an option where small businesses could participate in a program where, say, the state would take a share, the small business would contribute a share, and then the individuals would provide a share of the premium. It would take a lot of subsidies, especially for lower wage workers, to be able to afford to buy into that share, but it's a very useful model that would be able to leverage the best of what the private sector has to offer in this with the best that the government has to offer in terms of having a large pool of purchasers. Because a lot of studies have shown that once you have the coverage, you are more likely to get care, so you get preventive care, you are more likely to seek care in a lower cost setting, say your doctor's office as opposed to a hospital emergency room, and so the benefits of coverage are well documented and significant, and it really is an important healthcare right that people should have, and we can do a lot to encourage that and fill in the gaps where there are several market failures in our system that provide a situation where many individuals fall in these gaps.
We have been speaking with Michael Cassidy. He is the executive director of the Commonwealth Institute. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks very much.
This week's top three tips are about Social Security. The first tip is that Social Security is a federal program that pays monthly payments to aged, blind, and disabled people, and also to dependents such as children, spouses, parents, and survivors. The Social Security Administration runs the program. The second tip is that you don't have to be low income or have low resources to get benefits. You must have worked and paid enough Social Security taxes to get benefits. The third tip is that Social Security is like an insurance program and should not be confused with Supplemental Security Income, or SSI, which is like a welfare program. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and for this week, that's our top three tips.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. Also, if you have a question you would like answered or any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. Please include your name and phone number. You also can leave that same information before 8 a.m. or after 6 p.m. by calling 200-6045. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. It's tax season, and not knowing the tax laws could cost you hundreds or even thousands of dollars. Join us next week when Amy Durham from the Taxpayer Advocate Service and Paul Harrison from the Community Tax Law Project offer tax tips for the 2008 tax year and for your income tax filing due April 15, 2009. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.